It's time to get sexy, so watch Secular Sexuality live Thursdays at 7 p.m. Central. Visit tiny.cc/ytss and call into the show at 512-991-9242 or connect to the show online at tiny.cc/callsex.
Welcome to Talk Heathen. Today is the 19th of June, 2022, and I am Katie Montgomery, your host today. Hooray! And I'm joined by the amazing Kenneth Leonard. Kenneth, how are you doing today?
You know what? I'm doing great. Cannot complain.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. Talk Heathen is live. That means you can call in right now and talk to us and tell us some things, have some arguments. It should be a good time. If you'd like to call in, the number is just below. It is 512-991-9242. And you can also call in on the internet, super futuristic here, at tiny.cc/callth. And we would love to have some conversations with you. For anyone who doesn't know, Talk Heathen is a show run by the ACA, the Atheist Community of Austin, and it is a 501c3 organization dedicated to improving atheist culture and promoting the separation of religion and government, which is a very important thing. But maybe you're the kind of person who thinks that we should have a Christian theocracy or another religious theocracy. Maybe you could explain how, if everyone wants a different religious theocracy, how we should go about resolving that. But yeah, perhaps you could call in and tell us
which
why that would be amazing.
Of all the theocracies, which one should we party with? Yeah.
What we could do is have a different theocracy every week and just like rotate
on a rotating basis. Yeah.
What could go wrong? It would certainly be interesting. I feel like I would actually love to explore that idea. So if someone wants to call in, that would actually be quite interesting. I was just going to go off on one, but I think we should not fill up the entire show with weird hypotheticals straight away. So Talk Heathen is a show that we do for you. And if you like it, then perhaps you would like to support us. You can support Talk Heathen and the entire ACA altogether in a number of ways. For example, you could support us on Patreon at tiny.cc/patreonth. Or I guess you could go to Patreon and search for Talk Heathen. And Patreon is good. It means that the money doesn't get siphoned off to YouTube, which is often what happens with lots of these things. But maybe you do just like to stay around on YouTube, in which case, please do click like and subscribe and tick the bell and write a comment and join us in the live chat and do all the YouTubey things, because it's actually fun and it's also good for the video. And also you can become a channel member, which is like the next step up for all the cool kids. If you don't just want to be a boring liker, you can be a liker and a channel member. And then you get cool like chat emotes, and you can spam all kinds of nonsense in the chat within the limits of the moderators. And it would help us out a lot. I was considering, seeing as today is Father's Day, I was going to ask Kenneth about who he thought the worst dads in the Bible are, but perhaps we'll, I don't know, maybe do we want to mention one quickly before we go on to calls? Because we've got a few calls up lined up already.
Mention one specific worst father in
yeah,
scripture?
Who's your favorite?
Oh my gosh, the bottom of the bottom?
Dad?
I mean, there are so many to choose from. And it's always fun, like, because... like where I grew up in evangelical circles, there was this idea that, you know, to be like a good man, to be a good dad, you have to look at the example of the Bible. You have to follow the Bible to get those answers. And then you just look at the fathers in the Bible. You can look at Abraham, who was willing to kill his son to make God happy. You can look at Lot, who was willing to throw his daughters to an angry mob.
Lot's the one I was going to bring up because it's very like rapey.
Explicitly. like just overtly rapey. Yeah, please do what you will with my daughters. It's pretty rough. You can look at Noah, and the whole incest thing there. That's not particularly kosher. I think we talked about Jephthah, the one who was going into a battle and was like, you know, I'll sacrifice whatever walks through my door, God, if you'll give me this this victory. And then God gives him the victory. And then Jephthah's daughter walks in the door. Oops.
That was actually just confusion because God was like, oh, God, I don't want this to be really, really bad. So he just sent like a bed bug to walk through the door because but it was too small. It. He didn't see it.
Didn't
and
see it.
And then he killed the daughter.
Didn't see it.
So.
Damn it.
It was just poor planning.
That is like the most Monty Python scenario I'm surprised I haven't heard someone pitch that before to justify that story. But I think we can agree based on the talk we're having before the show that the worst father in the Bible would be God the Father. Yahweh is a pretty terrible dad. Unlike many of the other dads in the Bible, also kills other people's kids, not just his own.
Invented
vengeful,
kids, in fact.
Jealous, angry. Bitter, forgives you, but conditionally,
sexist.
Yeah, there's sexist. Yeah. Can't forget that. yeah. Jesus Christ. Yeah. There's a number of problems with, looking at the Bible for examples of what to do as a dad. So
though I do think that some dads do seem to have done that. So, you know, maybe he represents a wide range of, dad
right.
types.
Right. Yeah, I'm very, very interested in secular parenting resources right now. Looking at all of the things that are available in that world, and very frustrated that when I look up materials related to fatherhood, that I frequently encounter Bible stuff, spiritual nonsense. I've got my first kid on the way. I'm gonna be a dad in November. So, for today and today only, look at you guys. today and today only, if any callers want to refer to me as daddy, they can do it. But any other day, no.
I'm just going to hang up if you don't refer to Kenneth as daddy for this whole episode. So
yeah, there you go.
Anyway, talking of which, let's move on to a caller. So I would like to talk to this caller, Davan, perhaps, about the soul. And maybe Davan, you could, it's up to you if you want to call Kenneth daddy, but you know, you're totally welcome.
Neither encouraged nor mandatory, please.
But yeah, Davan, how can you want to explain how a soul exists?
Hmm. Well, actually, I think that the components are there. I actually don't believe in a soul in the fashion of religion. I believe that religion has a textual example of what they were experiencing back in ancient past, and they deemed it a soul, but it was really the beginning workings of a soul. The idea of evolution creating something that would be similar to a soul.
When you're saying a soul, are you thinking of something supernatural, or are you just using the word soul to describe some natural part of humans? For example, you might be saying a soul as in some magical ghost which comes out of us and goes to heaven, but you also might be saying soul as in like what makes humans art and things, you know, what makes humans human compared to chimpanzees or something. But in that sense, I would say that was like purely just a function of our brains. Like, in which way are you using the word?
Concerning the question itself, I actually don't know for certainty. When I look back at the texts of multiple different religions, they talk of specific experiences, and I've had multiple experiences of what's generally called an out-of-body experience. Now, because I'm extremely rationally minded, I believe it to only be a dream. But every experience of that out-of-body experience would tell me that something has actually left the physical body. In other words, the only reason why I believe that it's a dream is because I'm rationally minded. I'm overly skeptical about anything that I want to believe. But the actual experience itself, I have no reason to believe.
Some out-of-body experiences feel quite convincing, I guess. But like you say, so do some dreams. So
I'm wondering where you would point to this experience taking place? Like, where do your experiences happen?
Usually as I'm laying down in bed, getting ready to try to go to sleep or meditate or whatnot.
I don't mean any specific experiences. I'm saying all experiences. Where do your experiences happen? For you to experience something, where does experience take place?
Oh, you're talking about internally in the brain. Where does it take place?
Yeah. Well, maybe, because some people would say that. Some people would say that their soul is responsible for experiencing things. And what I tend to want to do is go, okay, well, what does the evidence tell us about where our experience happens? You know, our experiences can be altered by, or our experience of reality can be altered by altering the chemistry of our brains. You know, there's substances that you can take, exactly. You know, if you have ranging from coffee to psychedelics, right? Yeah. People tell me. When someone says to me that they've had an out of body experience, is there any reason to think that experience is
already specified that being a very literal and very scientifically minded individual, I'm relegating it to it being nothing more than a dream.
Okay. Yeah. So
the
what I'm
experience itself. So what I'm trying to specify simply is that think about a dream in and of itself. You can go flying out into space. You can go see dragons and all sorts of different kinds of monsters. Is it really so absurd to think that your brain can come up with an illusion of your bedroom with your physical body laying down on the bed?
Right.
Right. So what I'm trying to point to
that would be more common because it's something that your brain doesn't need to invent as much.
If we know that experiences happen at the level of our brains, then I'm wondering if what you're telling us is that this idea of a soul was a way for people who didn't know anything about our brains to try to explain the phenomena of experience. But I'm wondering I'm wondering how any given experience could be evidence for a soul if we know that experiences are actually the, you know, brain things.
Okay, so first and foremost, you're actually hitting the nail on the head as to what the people in the past were writing about as far as what I'm thinking. They were experiencing something and they were doing their best to explain what they were experiencing, and they dubbed it a soul. Now, there is the factor of what's referred to as proprioception, one of our multiple senses. Lots of people hear the five senses, where there's actually many more than five. Proprioception is merely a simple concept of knowing where your limbs are without actually having to look at them.
Yeah, it's an awareness of spatial relationship related to your body.
Yeah, there's lots of different senses.
Right. Yeah. So if the question is, does a soul exist? I just would go back to, I understand that pre-scientific folks,
I'm not saying that a soul does exist.
Right. I'm not saying that you are. Yeah. Okay, I'm just saying, keep going.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm trying my hardest not to step on you guys. And my phone is
all good
for some reason, glitching out a little bit. I recognize that. I believe that through an evolutionary process, that something like a soul could potentially exist. I think that all the pieces are there, like a puzzle. They're just not put together in the right place. Much like how evolution ends up screwing up what is best for I should have actually looked this up before I decided to call in.
I'm wondering if soul is not a well-defined concept in your mind, if you're referring to a quality of experience or something like consciousness, then I'm wondering why we're using the soul label.
Yeah, because I think for me, like, the when someone says soul, I'm only really interested in whether they're claiming there's some supernatural component to your existence, which has some properties other than just what your brain does. Because, you know, if we just call a part of your brain or your personality or something your soul, then, like, I just trivially agree it exists, like, that's cool, whatever. But if there's a supernatural part, then I want to find out how we prove that exists or not. And I think, I mean, my current position is we can quite convincingly or I'm convinced that there just isn't a part, because you can just cut people's brains out and then they're just a different person and they think different and they act different. And that wouldn't, you know, what is left? What part of a supernatural component, what information does that carry about someone if it's not going to have their personality or their memories or their emotions or their reactions or anything in it?
Yeah.
So I agree with you, this idea that, oh, you know, there's some experience that people have, even if it's a dream or whatever, and people go, oh, that we'll call that a soul. But then with our current knowledge today, we can say, well, does this make sense? You know, can all this be explained by a brain? And then also, you know, why would we assume there's some supernatural component? But even if we do assume it, then can we show that it exists or not? And I think the answer is no. So I guess that's why we're asking, which part do you consider it?
The problem is that most people take a very specific type of view of a soul, when in fact, and I actually had this conversation with a couple other individuals, Judaism does not actually take a concept of supernatural in the fashion that you're probably thinking of. Orthodox Judaism believes that the soul would die with the body.
I don't care.
Yeah, that's kind of like, I was just saying is that, like, if it's just some part of your brain, if we're just like, if the part of you that we could describe as your personality, and we just say, oh, well, that's the soul, and it's in your brain, and I can cut a bit of it out and change it, and when you die, it dies, like, okay, we can call that a soul if you want, but that's kind of uninteresting. We could call anything a soul, really. But what's interesting is if someone's claiming there's something else.
That was actually what was being discussed by the ancients, by ancient writings. It's only in more modern writings that things became more of what you're probably referencing as supernatural. But the idea of a soul in and of itself by the individuals who wrote more ancient writings was something that could be explained very physically.
Right. And I think that it's interesting that our idea of what some of these concepts are has changed over time. And there might even be situations like this where they were just describing some natural part of humans, but they didn't have all of the knowledge that we have today and all of the understanding. And they just had this kind of, they were aware that people have a personality and memories and emotions and stuff. And they just lump all that together and they say, that's your soul. They didn't necessarily know what brains are and what brains did and stuff. And they write that down. And then as we've learned more and more about what brains do, then that's left less and less space for what people call a soul, and then ends up sort of being relegated to a new concept. And this new concept of what a soul might develop over time, where they say, oh, well, it's none of those things. It's not your brain. It's something else. And quite possibly, I mean, I'm not an expert in the like history of souls or how they've been recorded, but I can certainly see that being possibly true, which I guess is an argument against the writings being false.
Part of that is what I'm saying, but part of it goes against what I'm saying. The development of what is called the soul is far different than what the ancients were talking about as a soul. What the ancients were talking, what people 3,000, 4,000 years ago were talking about as a soul, can be completely 100% explained by physical, rational explanations.
Wait a minute. Hang on. Let me ask you this. When you're talking about the conceptual soul in an ancient context here, are you talking about something that survives after the death of the body?
No, in fact, that's what I ended up specifying. Orthodox Judaism doesn't even accept the idea of a soul existing past the death of the body without a god.
The key word being there without a god, right? Key being there without a god, right? The qualifier. But in Orthodox Judaism and other religious traditions, they would agree that there's a god, right? That keeps your soul alive as this thing that exists on another plane after you're dead.
Keeps it alive. In which case, if a god does not exist, it won't stay alive. In other words, it dies with the body.
But that would apply to everything in that worldview, right? Like everything is sustained by God in these religious traditions, right?
Yeah, they premise God existing in their explanation. I don't think that's like a sudden little counter where if you disprove God, then suddenly, oh wow, we've taken out one of your premises. Like they've screwed up their entire worldview. And
here's where I'm sort of like reaching like limits to my patience, because I have no idea what we're talking about at this point. Because if what you're saying is there's this conception of the soul as being this thing that is essentially synonymous with our consciousness or having a quality of experience, and you know, there's an evolutionary basis for human beings having the ability to experience the world around them. Yeah, cool, fine. But if we're talking about a soul, and as Katie pointed out, if we're talking about a soul in a religious context, we're talking about something very, 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 very different. We're talking about something that's like this ghost in the machine that makes us who we are, that has some relationship to a spiritual realm. We're talking about something different. So what I'm just going to ask very, very directly is, I'm wondering, what is the point of your call?
I just got a beep in the middle or right after you said that. So I don't actually know if I'm currently online or not.
So. You are. You are online. So
okay.
You are.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm just really succinctly, what's the point?
My intention for calling was first and foremost the idea of the soul as it originally was brought about by text exists, and I believe that it can go further.
What do you mean by go further?
It can actually become something more just through the simple concept of evolution.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
The reason why me and Kenneth are
I have to admit that the idea is not very fleshed out. It's still very new in my mind, even after 2 years, because I haven't had very many individuals to talk with. Figure out a better way to explain it, and then I'll call back.
This sounds like a great thing for the Facebook group.
It could be an interesting call. I guess for future, like when you call back next time, how me and Kenneth are coming at this is if you imagine all of these different components of a human, if we're saying a soul is, and then the components it points to are just bits of our brain have evolved over time, like that, okay, fair enough. But that's uninteresting in the sense that we all probably agree that brains are real and that humans have personalities as a result. That's cool. And I agree that over time evolution will change them and et cetera, et cetera. That's fine. But what we would find interesting would be if someone called in and said, oh, well, maybe as well as, or instead as, just parts of your brain, a soul has some other component which isn't controlled by your brain, you know, that is kept alive by a god or whatever that means. And if that's the case, we want to be able to say, okay, well, what are you claiming? Like, there's a part of a human which isn't in their brain or their body. That's like the claim. And okay, now we know what you're trying to say. And secondly, what is the evidence for that? And can we have a discussion saying that maybe there is evidence that doesn't exist? And that, I guess that when people say souls, I get that you're coming up with an older definition, perhaps. That's fine. And you could say, oh, well, they used to be describing this. And then okay, does that mean they were describing just parts of humans? Okay, cool, trivial, uninteresting. Or were they also explaining non-physical parts, in which case suddenly it's a conversation we'd happily debate on the show. Do you see like the distinction I'm making there?
I think I understand, and in which case I have not actually gotten to that part. Do I believe that maybe in 100 generations we might actually be capable of becoming non-physical? Yeah, I believe that is a possibility. I haven't actually firmly rooted that part of this generalized discussion. My first primary idea was the discussion of the original beliefs of a soul. I definitely need to take some time. And as I specified, I do believe it possible in no less, probably 100 generations.
I think that would be an interesting... It'd be an interesting topic for next time, because I'm unsure quite where you're going with that. But we probably do need to move on. And so go and have a chat with some people go in the Facebook group or in the Discord. Yeah. We'll talk about those in a bit. And then, and we'll hear from you again in the future. But thanks a lot for calling in, Devon. As we were just saying, like there's actually lots of different ways that you can join in with the ACA. I might be confusing things up in an order here. I'm getting in all in the mix. But yeah, definitely come out and hang out on the Facebook, because it's the place where you can have all these kind of discussions and flesh out your ideas. So you can go to tiny.cc/FBTHG. And I found that, as ridiculous as it sounds, arguing with people on the internet can be good. And if you're going in with some strong idea to change people's minds, you are probably wasting your time. But if you're in a situation like the last caller where you're like, oh, I've got an idea, and sometimes things make sense in your mind a bit, and then you say them out loud to someone and they're like, what about this though? And you're like, oh, shit. And that is a good thing. It is a way of learning. You don't have to just read all the books and then jump straight in with a perfectly formed opinion. You do need to discuss with people and come in and talk in with some atheists and non-atheists and arguing with them. And it's a good thing to do. And you can improve your worldview, I think. But yeah, there's definitely come and hang out in the general community. You can do so in the chat below and all kinds of places. You know, the ACA is a great place for discussing atheism and atheist ideas. But yeah, obviously does need supporting as well. And that's why just below we have a fundraiser, which you could donate to if you would like, which helps support the community and the ACA and the mission here. And 100% of the proceeds of the fundraiser goes directly to the ACA. So there's no little sneaky cutout by YouTube or Patreon or whoever else you use as like a intermediary. So that's good. But if you really like the community, one of the coolest things you can do is go to the merch store and buy some cool merch. For that, you can go to tiny.cc/merchACA. And there's all sorts of cool Talk Heathen merch there. There's also there's one with like a picture of toast on there. I presume that's a cool thing to have on a t-shirt. No, it's really cool. there's new merch all the time in the merch store, and there's actually often merch which is only there for a short amount of time. It's proper limited edition. So if you ever see something there, don't think I'll buy it later. And this isn't just me pressuring. If you really want it, like obviously if you can't afford it, don't buy it. But if there's something you really want, it's probably going to disappear. So you need to get on it. Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, on other things, if you just want to listen back to all the shows, we now have a channel which has all of the ACA shows in podcast form. So you can go to tiny.cc/AENpodcasts. And you can listen to all the different ACA shows, including Talk Heathen and lots of other inferior shows with inferior hosts. No, they're all really good. It's a wide range of shows, and it's really cool to listen to. But yeah, so let's move on to another caller. We actually have loads of callers today, which is exciting. Yeah. So I think we've got a theist here who is in Croatia, which is exciting. Tio,
yeah.
And you want Hello. To talk about polytheistic worldviews mixing with Christian worldviews.
Not actually mixing, for not necessarily, because I think that a lot of people just choose one. I'm also doing the same heathen. That's how I. But I'm thinking about the possibility of a heathen experiencing the divinity of a Christian God, or perhaps a Christian acknowledging that heathen gods exist. Because this happened to me, and I've seen people say that both exist, like in the spiritual world.
When you say you're a heathen, what does that, briefly, what is a heathen to you? What does that mean? You believe in multiple gods, is that what you're saying?
Polytheist, and just basically not Christian, basically just the old God.
Really quick, are you on speakerphone by any chance? I'm just having a little bit of a hard time hearing you.
I have a laptop. I don't know how it works.
Okay.
It's just a laptop. I can't hear myself. Okay.
That's fine. We'll be able to make it work. So I guess what I'm wondering is, when we're talking about experiences with gods, how, and the key word is how do you tell the difference between an experience you're having with a god and something that's just the product of your imagination?
Because the god or a god would make sense on your journey. It would reveal to you that it makes sense and that it's logical. It wouldn't be something that just exists for fun. Like maybe as fun, but somehow it's spiritual knowledge. It works.
Sometimes, you know, though, I imagine... Hang on a sec. So the thing is, though, like I imagine things that I imagine things that are rational and make sense too. Like when I'm thinking about maths, for example, geometry, I can imagine like triangles fitting together and making like a hexagon. And that's something that I'm imagining in my mind. And I could imagine what all the different angles are and work on. And it's all rational. It's all totally provably true. Are you saying that I could only reach that with a god? Or are you saying that, like, what are you saying here?
Let's try to make this really, like, even simpler. So Teo, just really quick, and I promise I'll shut up. But based on what Katie just said, would you agree it is possible for people to imagine things that are logical and that make sense.
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Basically the mind.
All right. So then the question's still on the table. Yeah. How do we tell the difference between experiencing a God and something that's just a product of our imagination?
The God would reveal something to you, in my opinion, and it happens, and the spiritual path would have been walked upon by others in the past, and they would tell you a little bit about it, and then it would help you shape your...
But I could do that. So I could give you some advice, couldn't I? I could say, you know, like as a person who's experienced in whatever, you know, engineering, I could tell you, oh, here's some advice, make sure you do the maths first or whatever. And that's revealing something to you. And it's like a path I've trodden down before. And I could give you some, probably bad example there, but I could give you some fairly wise advice in some things that I'm an expert in. What's the difference between that and a God?
About how it all works together, you know, but maybe a Christian would just have to have the faith or the mist of the runes.
Okay.
The runes are not explained to everyone the same way.
Is it possible to believe things on faith that aren't true? Or to believe things on faith that are just, you know, imaginary?
I don't know, because it wouldn't matter. It would not really have any purpose to it. It would just exist in some kind of hole where it doesn't
matter. It could matter a lot. Like if you believed in a faith in your mind that you could cure a bacterial infection by drinking strawberry tea and you had no evidence, then that would be really bad, because rather than taking antibiotics, you would drink strawberry tea and then you would get ill and possibly die.
You would have to be able to think something that doesn't exist, like the ghost or somebody who doesn't believe in them.
Wait a minute. How do you know ghosts don't exist?
I don't know. Perhaps
that's the right answer.
I haven't seen one yet, but
right.
It could also be a concept about something, and then you would see for what the person who invented it would want to say.
Well, the reason I asked about the ghost thing and how you know they don't exist is because it sounds to me so far that all of the paths to believing in experiencing a God that you're trying to walk us down are paths that people walk down to believe in things like ghosts and spirits and psychics and all kinds of stuff. So, but if we really, really care about whether the things we believe are true, then how can we know we've had an experience with a God?
Because you would know that somehow connected to the divine. It wouldn't be something that's just mundane.
How do you know?
And regular.
Yeah. So again, it's how. So I was like, how can you know you've had an experience with a God? And you're saying, well, because the experience would be divine and you would know it. I'm asking how.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had a load of experiences. How do I know which one's by God?
The world and the life and the soul, the existence is divine. It's not that you would have to see something that doesn't exist. You know, you would see it in the nature and your feelings and the good things in life, the bad things in life. It would all somehow be explained by the element in the religion.
I mean, no offense, but this does sound like super hand-wavy and vague, because, I mean, I have experiences and emotions, and I see the nature, and I see the good and the bad, and, you know, I feel like things sometimes make sense and all this kind of stuff, but I don't see, like, how do I know when that's a God or not? If I go out into nature and I feel like, wow, this is amazing.
If you're a theist, I guess that's a part of where the God manifests. Otherwise, you could say that God only exists in your dreams like that.
Well, see, but the claim is that the God manifests. But what I'm asking is how can we justify acting like that's a true statement? You know, why should anybody believe that a God has manifested anywhere?
Otherwise, you would just have to say that he exists in the metaphysical realm somewhere else, and then he would serve a different purpose, because he would just explain some things about a hypothetical universe. And
there's another option, which would be to go, if there's not evidence for the God and we can't explain how we could tell the difference between God and our imagination, maybe you don't believe in the God. Maybe you just go, I don't know. I have some experiences and they're wild, but I'm not justified in calling them God experiences without evidence.
Yeah, if we just agree with you and we say the experiences, hang on a sec. If we would just agree and say, you know, these experiences or the gods in a metaphysical realm, whatever. Like, this reasoning you're using could be used to prove anything, really, couldn't it? This is like a classic atheist thing, but you could say, well, what's the difference between that and like a genie or something?
Yeah.
No, but if it helped you somehow because it was a part of you, then you were somehow involved. I mean, if it didn't matter at all, then it's not really spiritual, or it is, but then it could just be like another living being on the planet, like an ant, which is still somehow spiritual because it has the consciousness and can see and live.
Not all living things have a consciousness, though, right? Because not all living things even have a brain.
Yeah, not about everything at once, but they have a consciousness now. You can focus on what you can focus on. I mean, I don't think everyone is capable of tremendous multitasking.
Well,
I think we can quite conclusively say that not every living thing has a consciousness, because like what even it's very hard to define even know what consciousness is, but like I think we can confidently say it requires a brain. Or it requires some kind of...
And if we're going to start talking about living things, what does it mean for something to be alive?
Like viruses. I learned the coolest wasp fact ever. I'm going to say it off the
Let's. Sorry, can we hear the coolest wasp fact ever? I want to hear the coolest wasp fact ever.
Even the tree or the rock is somehow alive, somehow matter, because it's somehow there and you can't say that it doesn't exist. So it somehow it lives, I guess, a rock.
Ooh, is the time...
But somehow it exists. It exists in the plane of living things, you know, in the material universe.
Let me ask you this. If you can't prove something doesn't exist, is that a good time to believe that it does exist?
Maybe, but you'll never know if it only exists for you or forever.
Well, I don't think of existence as being something that's subjective, you know, like something would exist for me and not for someone else, you know what I mean? I'm wondering about this though. I cannot prove that there's not like a tiny leprechaun that lives up my ass and that I'm basically being like puppeted by a tiny leprechaun, right? That's, for lack of a better word, a soul.
That one's actually.
But I don't have any reason to I don't have any reason to believe that thing exists, even if I can't prove it doesn't. That the invisible puppet master ass leprechaun, you know, I don't think the time. Yeah, right. I don't think the time to believe in such a thing is when I can't prove it doesn't exist. Does that make sense?
Yes.
You know, I know it's a silly example, but
it's not a dog or a man. It's a leopard. You can only prove it for the people who will acknowledge it. It's sort of like a god, sort of, because
it is very much like a god in many many ways.
Anyway,
God, let today be the day that everyone bookmarks this as the day that a theist caller acknowledged that a god is very much like an invisible leprechaun that lifts up your ass. Yeah.
Well,
on that note.
Yeah, I think it's been an interesting discussion, Theo, but we've got a lot of callers lined up and there's some really cool topics we want to cover, and I want to crack out this amazing wasp fact. I think it would be cool for you to go away and consider what exactly you think would be like the evidence or the way of telling the difference between a god telling you something and you just coming up on with it on your own. Like how we know, like how could we look at 100 different instances of someone learning something and say 100% of the time which one of them were given by God and which one of them weren't. And that would make a really good call next time. But thank you very much for calling in, and we will talk to you again. This wasp fact. Sorry, I haven't just been thinking about wasps the whole time. I kind of have. Because we were saying, what's the difference between like living and not living? And the classic is a virus alive? And I found also all of these like lines in biology are actually really blurry and really difficult when you get down to them. And even like what is a different species and what isn't. For example, most of the cells in the human body are actually bacteria cells in terms of number of cells, but obviously the volume is mainly human cells because they're bigger cells. But that's like really interesting, because could you have a human without the bacteria? Would it even be able to exist? Like, that's key for your function. And then even within cells, there's parts where it's like this part came from a virus. But I've recently learned about this wasp which most wasps are parasitic wasps in that they lay their eggs inside a living creature and then the babies come out and eat it alive and come out. But they actually have all kinds of more mad stuff going on, because obviously if you inject something into something with an immune system, then the immune system fights back and it would kill the babies. And so lots of different creatures have different ways of dealing with this, like they either dodge the immune system in some way, like malaria does, or there's a whole range of different things. But there's actually one wasp which in its ovaries has all the components of a virus, but like separated out. And then when it goes to inject its eggs with its ovipositor, it like combines these proteins together and it actually makes a virus, which it injects into this caterpillar. I think it's the tobacco worm caterpillar or something like that. And it creates a virus which then attacks the immune system of the caterpillar and eats the components of it and basically gives the caterpillar the equivalent of AIDS. So it has no immune system at all. And then the wasp babies take hold in there. And then this virus is eventually defeated by the caterpillar and it gets a new immune system. But by that time, it's too late. Like, what I think is so fascinating about this is that part of the wasp? Like, the wasp actually creates the virus. So it's not that this is a symbiotic relationship between the wasp and the virus in the traditional sense. It's like the wasp is, in one sense, birthing a virus, and in another, completely relying on it for its life cycle. Anyway, really fascinating. Wasps are cool. Your face says you love that.
I mean, as much as I love, you know, the stories about caterpillar AIDS as much as the next guy, I'm just sitting here thinking that nature's freaking gross and crazy. Next time someone tells me about how perfect creation is and how everything's evidence of God, I'm going to be like, even caterpillar AIDS? And just see what they say.
Wasp-injected caterpillar AIDS.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got so many wasp facts. I think we need to do a separate show after this one where I just talk about wasp facts. But let's not do that. Maybe what would happen is if people supported the ACA enough, then the ACA would like give me my own special Nature is Horrific show. And theists can call in and tell me why God creating a type of wasp that does that is actually good.
That'll be a great show. On today's episode, feline leukemia. We've got a number of callers who want to talk about it. Jesus Christ.
There's probably more than one type. Anyway, no, I wasn't going to go on about caterpillar AIDS more. So, if you want to see a show that isn't Katie Talks About Caterpillar AIDS, then what you could do is watch The Nonprofits, which will be on after this show at 3 p.m. Central today. And you can go to tiny.cc/YTNP in order to see that. You could just go in the comments and be like, I don't care about any of this. What about caterpillar AIDS? And they will be like, what the fuck is going on? And it'll be, I'll love it. That'll make my day. So we also want to know, we want you to know, and we want to know that you know what is going on in our community. For that, we've got our new updated website where you can go to www.atheist-community.org, where you can learn about the organization itself and all of the policies and how you can get involved in being on the crew on my new caterpillar show, which would be amazing. And we want to hear, like, I personally would love to hear from you. And what the best thing would be is if rather than emailing like me, you email the show, but then give them some horrific parasite fact that they have to then read and then filter to me, because that would be amazing. So if you want to do that, then you could email us at tv@atheist-community.org, or you can message about religion or whatever, you know, other less interesting topics. We actually have loads of different shows, and we're going to have one more eventually, but we have loads of different shows other than Talk Heathens. We've got Nonprofits, Secular Sexuality, Truth Wanted, Atheist Experience, and they're on every week. And if you want to know what they're like, here is some fun clip.
That surviving on a single income in 2022 is next to impossible.
Right.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, there's just no way.
Say.
I think monogamy might be on the way out if inflation continues the way that it is.
Atheists probably get along most easily with pagans, I assume. Is that right?
Yeah. Probably the people that that have the rocks. Those people, I wouldn't be friends with those people. The rock people.
people who are like spiritualists.
The spiritual rocks, yeah. And the tarot cards and stuff.
And you know what? Greg Locke's institution is not there. It is not part of the institutions with 501c3. So he's renouncing nothing. He's just lying. A pastor lying! Shocking!
Like we've established on this show, reading, thinking, we're working on it. We're getting there.
Okay. We're getting there, Jamie. We're getting one there. Lesson at a time. We're going to go over vowels today after this. It's going to be a big day for you, bud.
It says that you can give atheists a way to pursue truth. Do you think that's something you could talk about? Because I know Dave likes truth. I've had truth just once or twice at a fancy restaurant, so I'm hoping to find some again.
All right, friends. Well, hey, there's something serious that I need to talk to you about. So recently, a call was taken from somebody who, in the past, doxed and threatened ACA show hosts online. Taking this call was a mistake, and we at the ACA apologize. But we recognize words are cheap, so we are also taking action. We've reached out to the affected members of our community, and with their guidance, we've taken steps to prevent this from happening ever again. So that there is no mistake, we will always support human dignity and rights through our words and through our actions. This is an ongoing process to which we are wholeheartedly committed. Working together, we can and will do better. If you are interested in reading more, you can read our full statement by visiting www.atheist-community.org, and you can reach us at tv@atheist-community.org. Thanks. Let's get some more.
Yeah, let's move on to the next caller. So we have so many callers, and there's a lot of good topics here. I kind of want to do this morals one. Are you up for a morals discussion?
Hey, you know what? I am the Chewbacca to your Han, the Laverne to your Shirley. So you take us wherever you want to go.
Okay, right. So we're going to talk to Chris from Scotland. And the tagline on this caught my eye, Chris. It's call screen has written down, is it possible to be a good moral person without knowing the worst you're capable of? That sounds like it could be a very potentially dark question. What was the thinking behind?
Is it possible for us to have a good call right now without knowing how bad of a call this could be?
Are you there, Chris? Oh, this is how bad a call could be.
Well, here we go. We're exploring this space of
Chris. You might be muted. If not, we will might have to move on to a different caller. Last chance. Okay, Chris.
Okay.
Perhaps we'll come back to you if you stay on the line and you work out what your tech problems were. In which case, we will go on to how about Judy in Indiana, who says here that perhaps you were previously a theist and you want to talk about whether we are stardust.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because it's Judy, and I have called several years back, and I'm in a long process of deconversion, and I'm like right at the tail end, and I know that there's no life after death. You know, I'm cool with that, and it's hard. You know, when I first found out, I was devastated. You know, like you know most people are who were you know Christians and you know believed all that stuff and everything, and you know, and it's still like it's still oh my God. kind of thing. And then, you know, in the Facebook groups and stuff, I had read that, you know, somebody was talking to a young child and mentioned a book about explaining to them about stardust, you know, that we're made of stardust. And I thought, it's interesting. And as time went on, I didn't do much with it. And then I read another an article online about that. And I thought, I'm going to investigate that. And I read an article that said that scientists and whatnot, I don't know the particular scientists, found from a planet far, 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 far away, fluorine was connected to the fluoride in our bodies, and it was an astronomical thing that they were able to connect an actual substance from a star so far away to our body. And then as time went on, I read that in the Big Bang, all the elements from the supernova from the Big Bang, all those elements are in anything that is in life today on our planet, anything that made up life on our planet, including our planet, all those elements is the stardust that we are all made up of. And I thought, that is just so cool.
Now, it is so cool.
I'm not a scientist. I'm not anything related to a scientist. I'm disabled. I can't get to a library to actually look up and delve further. All I have is Google. But this really settled my mind down, you know? It was very peaceful to me to think this. And I want to, this will make sense in a minute. I'm going to diverge off a little bit. Anytime that I had to have any kind of surgery, procedure, anything in the past, I was always begging God, saying, please don't let me die. Please don't let me die. Please help me. Let me get through this. Let me get through this. So much so that I would be crying going into the procedure. Now, in May, I had to have another procedure. In the days leading up to it, I was like, what am I going to do? Am I going to pop you out? How am I going to be? You know, and I knew about the Stardust thing going into this. And I was like questioning myself, what you going to do, Judy? What you going to do? How are you going to be? And I went into this procedure so totally peaceful. So peaceful, thinking about the Stardust thing. And I was just so amazing. Cool with myself, so cool with the knowledge of this. And I was like, I wonder, you know, when I came out of it, I was like, I wonder if this is really true. But you know, it's like the articles and the scientists that I read about. And so I was like, I'm going to call and see what you guys think of this. Is this real? Is this charlatans?
Think
of this? So, what do you guys really think of this?
Yeah, so I'm not a physicist or expert in the universe or anything, but I have studied this a little bit, and from what I gather, it's similar to what you said. Basically, at the start of the universe, it was just all a big mess and loads of matter and stuff. And it took a little while to settle down into things turned into atoms, because we often imagine that atoms are like the smallest thing, but they're not. They're made up of loads of different bits. They're made up of protons and neutrons and electrons, and then they're made up of things and so on. And it takes a little while for this stuff to settle down and form into things. But at the start, we basically just had hydrogen and helium, because they're the simplest two elements, and they're the ones that have just one proton, and then the one has two protons, and anything bigger than that actually was created in stars. So there was the Big Bang, and then there's loads of hydrogen helium everywhere, and over millions of years it clumps together and very slowly forms up into dust clouds, or you know, clouds of hydrogen and helium. And then as more and more of that comes together, it gets closer and closer together because of gravity, and then it builds into a star. And when you get enough of it clumped together, it gets so close together and so dense that it gets really hot. And in the heat of this is what a star is. It's burning hydrogen and helium from all of the heat inside. But because of the pressure and stuff in these stars, when you get really big stars, it can form other elements by combining them together. And that's called nuclear fission. Nuclear fusion. Okay. I always mix up the two of them. But basically, it creates heavier elements. So all of the other elements on the periodic table are created inside stars. And then as stars, this is my understanding anyway, I'm sure we might get a slight correction in comments or something, but as you get to a point where some stars, they get quite old in their lives, and some of them will supernova, which is where they explode. And then all of these heavy elements they've created inside get scattered, you know, for huge, huge, huge distances, light years of distance over time. And when you end up then, the next generation of stars forms, because all of the stars we have now weren't around at the start of the universe. They fought, you know, some stars form, they explode, and then their remains turn into a new star, and then they form up, and then maybe they supernova. I don't know what generation of star we're on, but as that happens, you end up with all of these other heavier elements also being around, and they clump together and they form like planets. And that's where we have like rocks and metals and stuff from. So in that sense, whenever we have an element that is heavier than hydrogen or helium, it's come from some, you know, either some process inside a star or from a supernova or something like that. And in that case, we might be able to say, oh, well, there's fluorine here on Earth, and we can see fluorine over there, and we can see it over there, and we can see it over there from its different chemical signals. And we're like, oh, well, we know a supernova happened here, and that's in that way they're connected. So I could see that we could say that there might be elements from all around the universe, or all around the galaxy at least, which are all connected to us in the way that they were once created inside the same like furnace, which is really cool. And I agree with you that often what I find really calming when I'm stressed about anything, you know, like a surgery or bad things going on in politics or something, I just think like, compared to the universe, all of my stresses and worries are just kind of immaterial. Like, so what? Like, the universe doesn't care. I don't know what you think along those lines, Kenneth. Do you know anything more about this process?
Well, I think you're summing up the process, you know, probably better than I could have. And the thing that stood out to me with Judy was a brilliant question that you asked, Judy. And I was so happy to hear you ask it when you were saying, how can I know if this stuff is true? I think you asked, are these people charlatans? You know, how do we know?
Yeah.
And the really, really great thing about science, and since you're talking about going through a lengthy deconstruction, I just want to draw your attention to this, because I think that the more you look for it, the more it'll just be like everywhere you look, frankly, with respect to the difference between religious claims and scientific claims. Scientific claims need to be supported by evidence. If they're not, then they are not scientific claims. They're something else. When I was coming out of being a Christian, which I was for more than 20 years, and I was a young earth creationist, when I started to learn more about science and see how the methodologies for arriving at our conclusions were so different in the religious world versus the scientific world, it blew my mind to see the difference in how truth is valued in the scientific community versus the religious community. As you keep going down this path and keep learning and reading and stuff, I would direct you to check out, you know, science educators, people like Carl Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson comes to mind for stuff about cosmology.
Yeah.
Forrest Valkai, you know, here, friend of Talk Heathen, does an excellent job on his YouTube channel of showcasing, you know, how to think about science, how to engage with science. Because the question you're asking of how do I know is the question.
Yeah.
So I would encourage you to keep poking and prodding and testing your conclusions, because that's what people who care about truth do.
Yeah.
Okay.
And often you can learn even more in the process, because you can say, well, how the hell do they know that like the fluorine on Earth come from this supernova? And then you'd be like, oh, okay, well, let's look that up. And then someone will explain and they'll say, oh, you know, the elements were created inside a star and then there's a supernova. And you're like, well, how do they know there's a supernova? And then you can look up and see how the process they used to do that. And I mean, this is how I've got super interested in some topics is, I mean, Wikipedia is actually a good starting point. If you've got the internet, you were saying, then it's cool, because you can go to like, if you look up supernova, perhaps on Wikipedia, and then you read through and you'll get like halfway through the first paragraph and it'll be like, a supernova is this. And you'll be like, oh, what does that word mean? And then you start reading the next article and then you're like, well, what does that word mean?
Yeah, you get sucked in.
You can get sucked in. And the important thing here is that, like Kenneth says, you know, a religion could write a big story and they could explain all of this stuff. But the difference here is that we have a process to learn about the world. And if we have a claim where we say, oh, fluorine comes from supernovas or whatever, we should be able to test that. We should be able to make predictions. We should be able to say, because earlier we were saying, oh, the fluorine on Earth, you know, comes from this supernova, and we saying it should be on this planet. What that means is another planet in this like blast radius, we should be able to say, well, we think potentially all of the planets in this range should have some signature of fluorine on them. And then we find a new planet, and then we should be able to test that. And we should be like, well, according to our model, according to our understanding of the universe, according to science, there should be fluorine on this planet. And then when you look and then there is, you'll be like, well, that's a good sign for our model. And if there wasn't, then either the model is wrong or there's an extra component that we haven't understood that we then need to add in. And that's like the scientific process, which is what is exciting about science. And, you know, Wikipedia is a great starting point, but that, you know, then you can talk to actual experts and it's great.
And you'll notice the experts won't tell you, oh, well, you know, you just have to experience this for yourself. The experts won't be like, oh, well, you just leave it on faith or whatever. It's going to be a conversation about evidence, which is awesome.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay. Well, thank you so much for pointing me in the right direction and keep digging. Okay. Well,
yeah, absolutely.
Keep going.
Have a great rest of your day.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. You too. Right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Judy.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye. I'm really sorry, Kenneth, at the end of that last call, I had to sneeze and I forgot that we have this shared green screen and I just sneezed all over you.
It looked like you were trying to tell me a secret and I was like, hell's going on?
I leaned
on?
In to tell you another wasp fact, but you weren't listening, so I just sneezed instead.
We got some good-looking topics piling up here.
We have, I know. So I'm going to quickly, I'm going to go through with the respect they deserve. We're going to just highlight our top five patrons this week. I'm going to do it slow and respectfully, and then we're going to rush on to another call because it's really exciting to talk to all of these cool callers. But so this week, we have five amazing Patreons, and if you would like to support the Patreon, the link is just below on the screen, tiny.cc/patreonth, and then maybe you can be read out slowly and respectfully. So we have number one, Eric Tweet. Number two, Dinglebury Jackson. Number three, Balaam's Donkey. Number four, I nearly got the number wrong then because I was going to say five. That would have been a total fail, wouldn't it? We'll go to number five, Dan Conger. And then number four, most important of all, is AME. And then we also have an honorable mention for number six, the Bearded Skeptic of TikTok.
There we go.
Who isn't you, even though you are a Bearded Skeptic of TikTok.
Correct. Not to be confused with the Bearded Skeptic of TikTok. I'm just some other asshole on TikTok.
Don't get a flipping own brand generic ripoff. Get the original. But yeah, right, let's move on to some coolers. So we've got, are you thinking this top one here, perhaps number 10? Or
sounds good.
Are you looking at some? Okay, right, let's do it. Let's talk to Tony from New York, who wants to talk about atheism only working in the physical world. That's an interesting statement.
Hello. Hi, guys.
Hi, Tony.
Can you hear
me? Hi.
Oh, sorry, sorry for saying that. That was literally, oh my God, my bad. Hey, guys. I'm just primarily just to get the point that I'm getting across. I'm a deist. I just don't, like, I feel like atheism only works in the physical world. Outside of that, it can't, like, in our psyche, because we still need it. Like, you guys just mentioned your topic. That's because people donated to it. So money is still, in a sense, a god that we kind of worship. Even though it's in the physical world, it's still something metaphysical. It still has no actual value. You know what I mean? Money itself doesn't really have a value. It's imaginary.
I can prove money exists, though.
I'm instantly curious, like, when you're using terms, and I'm wondering what you mean by them. Like when what do you mean by atheism? What is atheism?
Well, atheism is just that you don't necessarily that you don't believe God exists, but you have no evidence for God exists. That, like, if
I'm unconvinced.
If you, like, I'm just unconvinced that God exists.
Yeah.
That's what atheism is.
That
whole thing is just the same thing as Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and everything like that.
Yeah. So would you say, just by analogy, would you say, just to help me understand, would you say that not believing in Santa Claus only works in the physical world?
Well, yes, because we only exist in the world. But I'm saying that the belief of Santa Claus does have ramifications in the physical world. Every Christmas, I got to see Santa Claus, every things like that. So it does have ramifications in the physical world. But as part of the physical world, as part of being something that actually exists, isn't. But even the thing of truth is objective. So, I mean,
hang on, let's just break that up. Sorry, one second. Just breaking that up. Like, I think all three of us agree that Santa Claus doesn't exist, but the belief in Santa Claus does exist in the world, and we have actions and traditions and stuff
in the real world.
Yeah, and we could say, I'm making the strong claim that Santa Claus doesn't exist, but maybe if we back off and just say I'm unconvinced Santa Claus doesn't exist, then we can say it's the same with God, in that I'm unconvinced God exists, but I'm convinced the belief does.
What about money? Just instead of Santa Claus, use money. It becomes more difficult because you feel like money is something real, but it isn't.
Money is something real.
Yeah. I mean, even if it's just a social construct that we've made up, it's still a thing. Like, I could give you some money.
You can argue that about God.
No.
I don't think we can.
Truth.
So we use these, you know, words to describe concepts, constructs, as Katie just said. So yeah, money is a word for this thing that has some transactional value, you know, currency. If someone were to ask me to demonstrate that money exists, I could go over my wallet and grab a dollar and we could talk about what this piece of paper. Listen, this is the thing. When you interrupt me, I can't
hear
you.
Hang on a sec, Tony.
When Tony, when you interrupt me, I can't hear you. So it's, you're going to have to, we're going to have to try to take turns talking like in a conversation. So if someone were to ask me to show them money exists, I can go grab a dollar or a pound note if I'm in the UK, or a pound coin.
We don't have pound notes. What are you on about?
Right. That's why I changed to a coin. I was like, So, and then I could hold up my little coin with the picture of the queen on it, and they could go, what is that? What does it do? And we could talk about what it is and what it means for something to be money. Why the pound coin is different from just like a bit of metal I pick up on the ground. Why one has value, why one doesn't. So money very much does exist. And in a way that the God thing doesn't. Go for it.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
That's the third time asking the same question. So clearly you can.
Thank you.
If
the same way you said, you can pull out a dollar or a pound, a euro, a lek, a dinar. You can take these currencies and you can take them out and say, look, this is currency. How is that any different than someone saying, look, this is a Bible. This is God. Look, this is the Quran. This is God. I'm talking about what is the actual truth?
Well, I agree that the Bible exists.
Is there a distinction?
I agree that the Bible exists.
Is there a distinction between...
No, I'm
saying... In the same way that there's a distinction between the physical paper money that I have and the authority that guarantees that it has value and all the constructs that guarantee that it has value, there is a distinction between the Bible and any alleged authority that would give it value. We can show that the Queen exists... We can show that the U.S. Treasury exists.
One, like, if you think about it, like, that's why you can't, it's difficult to be an atheist, because somebody can tell you that money is just as fictitious as God. You have no way of debating that, because deep down...
Well, we were in the middle of debating it. What are you on about?
I just addressed that.
There's loads of different, like, when you were just comparing money to the Bible, hang on, Tony, when you were comparing money to the Bible, I mean, in that direct comparison, I believe the Bible exists. I believe money exists. And so you brought up all these different currencies. And if someone comes and cracks out a euro in the USA and they try and buy something with it, someone's going to be like, well, that's not worth anything. Whereas if you do that in Germany, it is going to be worth something. So in the sense that you're talking about, the physical money obviously exists wherever you take it, but this kind of concept of value that humans have made up only exists when you're in an area where people have that shared understanding. And you could say, well, religion has the same thing, because there are people who have a shared understanding of God and it causes them to change their behavior and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah, right. So I'm on board in this comparison, in that money requires a social construct in order for it to do the thing that we usually use it for, because you could also use money for art or whatever. But and it's the same with the Bible and the same with God. But all we've done here is agree that it's something humans made up and would stop existing if we stopped existing.
Exactly.
If all of the people who had ever encountered a euro before all disappeared tomorrow, then the euro would be worthless. But, and if someone just discovered a bunch of them on the floor...
Because you see, the thing is, though, the same way you have euros, dollars, pounds, lek, dinar, the same way you have the Torah, the Bible, the Quran, Hindu, which has its multiple variants of beliefs in it.
Yeah, I mean, we've all got the bits of paper. They physically exist.
Yeah.
And then we've got the ideas. The ideas are real ideas that people believe in. But that doesn't mean that the gods described are true, because if all humans died out tomorrow, money would not have an intrinsic value. And if all humans died out tomorrow, the beliefs in the religion would not have any intrinsic value, and the God that they describe wouldn't exist.
Human beings are prone to these beliefs means that it's impossible for us to escape some form of theology.
What?
You're
talking to two atheists right now. I mean, I'm curious, like, this has been a very interesting call. So we started with atheism only works in the physical world. And it's like, I don't know why we would think any other world exists. And now we've gone down this weird rabbit track of like trying to figure out if money exists. Like, I'm wondering what the point of the call is.
Because we don't only exist in the physical world. You have,
why do you think that?
I can say things to you right now that can irritate you, and you can be like, fuck you, get off the phone. You know what I mean? So we do exist more than just in the physical world.
Chemicals in your brain, mate.
Yeah. Why would an emotional response to certain stimuli have anything to do with something non-physical?
I mean, the same reason why people have put Santa Claus outfits every Christmas. The comparison is exactly the same. It's the fact that those chemical buildups in our brain will always have ramifications, whether it be through some form of belief or another. I'm trying to say that we can never escape that because of those chemicals, because of the
but
way.
What is?
Yeah, but that's all still physical world. Like your brain structure that has your memories and the chemicals inside your brain. That's all the physical real world. And you know about Santa Claus. And in a future where we know how the brain memories work and everything, I could potentially go in with a scalpel and cut out all the bits of your brain that are aware of Santa Claus, and you wouldn't know anymore.
Really, because it's the scalpel would have to be really tiny, because you'd have to be playing with knots. It would be almost.
I feel like that in our future world, that's a ridiculous caveat that I was kind of overlooking.
I feel like the Andromeda galaxy would collide with us before we get to that understanding.
But again,
possibly. Like, so, but so what I'm saying is, it's in the physical world, and you said
there's another
world. Yeah, what's the
evidence of there being a non-physical world?
Well, no, we exist in the physical world, but our thoughts are in a non-physical world. And our thoughts.
Why do you think that?
Yeah, I'm not convinced. What's your evidence for that?
Yeah,
what's
why do you think our thoughts exist in a non-physical world?
Well, no, our thoughts bring about our physical action. We can think things and then produce them. That's why.
Yeah, but thinking's just chemicals and electricity and stuff in a brain.
Yeah,
that's got some physical structure.
Actual things. Somebody had to think of something good to happen. Somebody had to think of something bad to happen.
Right.
Do something. That's what causes.
But you're talking about
actually exist.
You're talking about actual things causing other actual consequences. I mean, our minds.
I'm talking about thoughts causing consequence. People can and act on those thoughts. This isn't a new concept.
Why do you think that thoughts are non-physical?
Because they're not physical. You can't physically. You can't. You think you, nobody. I can show you a photo of someone that's crying, and you can't tell me if they're crying because they're happy or they're crying because they're sad.
That has nothing to do with whether our thoughts are physical or not. That has nothing to do with whether our thoughts are physical or not.
No, but how can you display, how would you show me happiness? How would you show it in the physical world?
Do you mean the concept?
Happiness? What is anger?
Do you mean how would I show you like the concept of happiness? Like, I'm not sure what you're even asking me.
No. How would you show me happiness? Because in your belief, everything only exists in the physical world. So physically show me happiness. Physically.
Well,
so I wonder if I can maybe shed some light onto this conversation by coming in from a completely different angle. And it's this idea in like the philosophy of language, which I'm absolutely not an expert on. So I'm probably going to dick up just as much as I did my explanation of how the universe works just now. But
you're pretty good.
We have this. Thanks. We have this like idea, and like the classic example is a tree. And when I say a tree, we all know exactly what I mean, or we think we do, because we've got this like shared understanding and we communicate it and stuff. But if we come up with a new, like you meet a new language, new people who speak a word, and they point at a tree and they say like bleh, you might think, oh, they mean tree, because they pointed at a tree, and my understanding is that is a tree, but they might not be doing that because they are pointing at something, and in their understanding, they might have a totally different set of concepts available to them. They might not have any matching concept for tree. They might be pointing at something and it's just life in general, or they might be pointing at it because it's green and it's the word for green, or they might be pointing at the tree and saying oak, and they only have a concept for oak, and they don't have a general concept for trees, and they point at another one and they say a different word, and they say pine, and for them they are totally two different separate concepts, and they haven't got the idea of evolution and thinking these two things are related. And you, basically we end up having this idea where language is like mapped onto reality in some way, but we have this like shared understanding. And to say whether some of these concepts that we come up with, especially when we're talking like harder to define things like emotions, you might find that in some languages there are words for emotions that easily map, like very common emotions like happiness. Probably every language has a word that means happiness, but then there are some words, some emotions which are very difficult to describe. Like there's a classic feeling, which is Schadenfreude. I can't even probably say it. But it's
Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude, does it? And the reason we take that German word is because there just wasn't a mappable word already existing in English.
Yeah.
But what that means is, does that concept even exist if you're unaware of the word of it? Or did that concept exist all the time and we were trying to describe it? Or are there other emotions which are covered by other words, so we just kind of use happy for all of these different emotions in another language? It's the same with colors. Some languages don't have a word for blue, for example. Does that mean blue doesn't exist? Or does it mean when they look at something blue, they actually conceptually have it in their mind as teal, for example, because they have a word for that. Anyway, the reason why I'm coming in with this angle is we could say that socially, concepts exist in a way which isn't necessarily, I've kind of maybe, I don't know how well I've explained this, but sometimes we could say, oh, when I say a word, oh, it definitely exists. But in another language, they might not even have that concept, even though that they would agree that the thing you're pointing at is real. And in that sense, all of our communication is... yes. Oh, anyway, just to finish that thought, what I'm saying is that the concepts aren't necessarily a physical thing. All concepts in all language. And they're like a shared cultural understanding. I don't know how good a job I've done of that, but this feels to me like a way of explaining what you're trying to say, in that it's not a physical thing. The idea of turquoise isn't a physical thing. It's just a color that you point at and other people know what turquoise means. Yes, but in other languages, they might just say blue.
We give into it. But yeah. We just associated that. And we can have many different associations of things.
Yeah, and different cultures have different ones.
It's because that money has such a sway. Like, the reason I revert, and I'm going back to money, is that money is not something that actually has power over us in society.
Yeah, but we made it up.
And it's the same way as we've made up a God. The thing, though, is that it's very, it would be difficult for me. That's why I'm still like, I'm a deist. That's one of the reasons, but not the prime. The prime reason is because I feel like we've existed for eons. Like, as a child, I've asked my parents, where did I come from? They said their parents, and their parents came from their parents, and their parents. So I'm like, oh, there had to be a beginning of consciousness, sort of. I mean, a beginning of all of these types of thoughts.
Well, that's like a sidetrack. We can come back to it later, potentially. But on your money point, what I'm trying to do is say that, we can make these one-to-one comparisons with religion. We can say, oh, well, we have a physical piece of paper, and we have a physical Bible. That's a comparison. We have these social concepts which we can communicate to each other in language about money, and they can cause people to do real world things, and they can have good and bad ramifications, etc., etc. And it's the same with money and the Bible or any religion. That's like a one-to-one mapping.
No, but I'm trying to say that.
But then we also, in religion, we are making this claim that a God exists. And what's the mapping here? What in money maps the claim that God exists?
No. I'm explaining to you why how it maps it, because it's the same thing. It's just, if you get rid of, it's easier to attack the older religions. I can find fault in Muhammad. I can find fault in I can find fault in all the Hindu teachings, because it's easier to find fault in them. It's harder to find fault in money because it's a concept that we still use, so we still feel like it has some sort of necessary value to us, even though it's still the same thing. We're just trading one thing for another.
What do you mean by find fault in, though, is what I'm wondering.
I used the wrong word. I didn't mean trade. We're not trading in one for another, but we're programmed in a way that we're always going to be drawn to something like this. We need that sense of structure. We need that sense of order.
Well, humans might be, as a culture, like... As a species, the claim humans are drawn to making up religion, I accept that. That's fine. But to say that we individually need religion, I think we can just say is demonstrably false, because me and Kenneth don't believe in a God. Huh? I need money to live the life that I live today.
Money,
you don't need money to live, theoretically. You could.
So you need money to be happier, the way some people need religion to be happier.
So here's the problem.
Okay.
Given,
I don't agree with that claim either.
We're not, like, I'm going to quote Christopher Hitchens. I'm probably butchering what he said in a sense, but the gist of it was that human beings are drawn to religion like a child is to their favorite teddy bear or their blanket, that they'll never
depart from. And he says they'll never let it go. I know he said that. I remember him saying that. The thing with money is, given our current social arrangements as a species, money serves a necessary purpose. In a variety of contexts, there's
the same way religion serves a necessary purpose to someone else.
Okay, so you're not listening.
Yeah, let Kenneth finish.
I've gone ahead and hit the mute thing because you're just not listening. So I'm hoping that I can do you a favor here. So money, objectively, is useful given our current circumstances. For our species, it serves a purpose. Okay, now would it be possible to just do away with money? I guess we would have to really overhaul how humanity does business to do so. But religion, while there are people do find uses for religion, there is nothing for which religion is essential. There is nothing that you can get to via religion that you can't get to via purely secular means. Do you disagree with this statement?
I do disagree, only because you're not, like, you're trying to diverge from the fact that they're the same thing. Like, you're saying
they're not the same thing. But let's stick with religion and your claims with respect to religion. Is there anything that religion is essential for, that religion gives us that we can't get to via secular means?
Yes, the concept of money. We would have never developed the concept of money had it not been for religion. We would have never been
that by this concept just had it not been for
religious. That's quite a claim, mate. I'm not convinced.
Just completely wacky nonsense. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm gonna try asking again. Is there anything that we couldn't achieve via anything desirable for humanity that we couldn't achieve via secular means for which we need religion? Anything?
Well, the question is asked in a way that I have to agree with. You're aware of this, right?
No. Maybe you can think of something that religion can give us that we need it for.
The question is asked in a way that I have to agree with you, because it's sort of, you put me in this, you're trying to put me in a situation where it's like, how can human beings achieve something without, like, the question? What was the question again?
The question is there anything positive that our species needs that we need religion for that we cannot obtain via just secular means?
You see, the question right there is, why positive? I'm focusing on the negative connotations that we still have for our place.
Well, yeah, there's tons of negative shit that we can get to via religion that is,
and we don't need it. I think the reason Tony, the reason that Kenneth is asking this is because you are saying things like, oh, we need religion. Some people need religion. And I just don't believe it. I don't need religion. No. And I think anyone could get to a point where they don't need religion.
I'm saying that it's not that we don't need, and I'm not saying about the necessity of religion. I'm saying that we're plagued by it regardless if we think we can escape that, even if we...
I agree with that.
Well, sure.
Religion exists in the world, and...
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Regardless of what we do, we're prone back to this type of ideological... And I'm saying, how can we escape this ideological...
Right, so I mean, that is kind of the point of this show, in that I think everyone on the, you know, in the ACA and the wider atheist community is well aware of, today we cannot escape the tendrils of religion. Like, it affects politics, it affects society, it affects, like, individual actions. Absolutely. But the whole point is, we're saying, well, we think that that's not necessary, and even that often we think that's bad, and therefore we're working to change the world so that's not the case. And you could say, oh, well, it's impossible.
And if we're talking about something like money, I mean, like, I went to the grocery store this morning to get food for my family, okay? So to do that, I needed some money, okay? I needed to farm. Where am I? How am I going to acquire the land for farming?
With a gun.
With my family here.
You see, it goes back to the whole thing. You're still plagued by the idea of money.
No. I'm asking you. I'm not talking about the idea of money. I'm talking about actual freaking dollars, my guy. So if I want to take care of my family, right, which I do.
Mm-hmm. You need a house, shelter, you need food, you need clean water. These are things that
you can
provide for yourself. But we've been believed and programmed in a way that you can only get these things through dollar amounts.
This is complete nonsense.
I do kind of agree
nonsense.
With Tony in one sense that, you know, it's often very difficult for people to imagine. Like, the thing that what's difficult about this conversation is we keep switching the context of it. Like, in general, I agree that most people are grown up in a world where they don't really question whether we could live with a world without money. And if you say, oh, well, why don't we have a world without money? It seems ridiculous to them, and they can't even conceptualize it. Fair enough. But again, when we compare this to atheism or like the goals of this show, you know, there's probably a group of people out there campaigning hard to get rid of money as a concept, and none of them are going to say to you, money doesn't exist today, or tomorrow we'll be able to solve the problem. They're going to say, this is a long-term goal, whether you agree with them or not, whatever. But similarly, if we're doing our comparisons between money and religion, as atheists, we're not saying religion doesn't exist. It obviously does. We can all see it all around us every day. And equally, we're not saying we can end it tomorrow. But what we're saying is, we believe that it is possible for the world to function without religion, and it doesn't benefit us. And it would be good to teach people That's not necessary. And it doesn't mean I want to ban other people from having their religions or stop them having freedom of religion or anything. But explaining and showing to people that they don't need religion for something, because often feeling like they need it is the problem that stops them from living their lives in a better way. And that's the difference here. So, what, you know, if you're calling in to say you think God exists in another realm or something, that's a different conversation to whether you're saying, you know, if you're saying to us, oh, well, I don't think that atheist activists can actually create a world where there isn't religion. I mean, okay, that's a question of practicality, and that's something where, like, you know, I'd like to create a world without murder as well. And can we ever do that? Probably not, but we can certainly reduce it. And it's the same with this. I mean, I don't, that's my position anyway. I feel like that's kind of the best I can do with this conversation. Sorry if we got frustrated a bit today, Tony, but it was a good discussion. But we are near the end of the show, and there's one caller that we'd like to take. So thanks for calling in, and please do call back if you can refine your ideas. But we are going to quickly move on and take Chris, who we tried to talk to earlier in the show, who hopefully can now hear us. And Chris, who's from Scotland, wants to talk about, is it possible to be good and moral without knowing the worst you're capable of? Which I thought was really... Hi, Chris. Great, we can hear you. Go for it.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. I was just curious about... it's great to be on the show, by the way. I was just curious about, you know, is it possible to be a good person when that's all you have? You know, can you be a good person without knowing the worst you're capable of?
Let me ask you this. This is like asking, is it possible to be healthy without knowing how sick you can be?
Is that definitely true, though? Because not to argue with you kind of like straight up, but like,
yeah,
I guess another comparison would be, is it possible to be happy without knowing what it's like to be not happy? And maybe that's because that is another comparison, and we could say
by comparison. Yes. Yeah. Can you have happiness without having some awareness of what it means to be sad?
Because you can certainly be healthy, because we could just define healthy as the typical state that most people are in. Like, you know, healthy's got some subjective definition, but like, you could just live in that state your whole life without even being aware of it. Whereas just existed in a typical state and then one day you like stub your toe, and you're like, wow, this is bad. Suddenly the rest of my life is put into context. It's been so good compared to this moment. But like, it's the same. If you're just like, just go around just helping people and like living your life or whatever, if that's something if you do the same thing every day, that's good. I mean, it's good compared to what other people do. But like,
I used the example of health on purpose because health as a concept is not particularly well defined, you know.
Yeah.
When there's different metrics that can be used for health, I think in the same way as we can use with respect to morality. But I think I'd love to hear what Chris's thoughts are now.
Hi there. By all means, I think that you do have a point. You can certainly experience health without experiencing illness, but can you fully appreciate the happiness you feel without that stub toe, without that whatever that is you experience? Can you feel it as fully? Can you feel happiness as fully without feeling sad, without feeling angry, without feeling despair?
I guess what's interesting here is you could feel it in compared to viewing other people feeling bad stuff. Mm-hmm. Like if you were healthy and you'd never known anything different, and then you saw someone who like all their teeth were like rotten and painful and they were like really struggling to eat, and they told you, my teeth pain is unbearable and it makes my life really difficult, you might be like, wow, suddenly I appreciate not having horrific toothache. It's not even something I've considered before. I didn't even know your teeth could hurt, but now I know, and I can appreciate that. And in the same way, like I can live my life trying to be as moral as I like, as I can, and I don't know what the worst I'm capable of is. I mean, who does really? I mean, there are probably are some people who have explored it and they're in, hopefully, you know, not able to do that anymore. But what I can do is look at the atrocities in humanity, and I can, firstly, I can see what other humans have done, but I have a decent imagination, unfortunately, and I can imagine things that humans could do or even that I could do. And then I can compare that to my actions and be like, well, you know what? There are some people who, without asking, put mayonnaise in sandwiches, and I never do anything that evil. And just without having, I don't need to do that in order to see that I'm a better person than that. So,
I understand what you mean. I'll be honest with you. What got me thinking about it was I've been watching a guy lately called Jordan Peterson, and I don't necessarily agree with all of his opinions, but some of them I find interesting. And he was positing the argument that, you know, it's the whole Jungian shadow self thing, that can you truly know the best of you without knowing the worst of you? Can you truly, right, you know, is being harmless the same as being good? That kind of thing.
Yeah. And it's
your thoughts there on it.
I just want you to know that any criticism that I have toward Jordan Peterson is not directed at you, Chris.
There is valid criticism to be had.
I would think so. I think that, you know, if I heard Jordan Peterson, you know, like when I think of like the pinnacle of like, I don't know, healthy athletic performance stuff, I have a great deal of admiration for people who do like ultra marathons and like extreme endurance events. And like, I think that if Jordan Peterson were to be like, well, you know, would you be able to run a marathon if you'd never had leukemia? Nobody would take his ass seriously. Nobody. But when we talk about it in the context of morals, for some reason, it's like, I don't know why all of a sudden he has credibility, because it is an equally vacuous idea. And I think that it's because morals are not well defined. You know, if we're talking about morality just being a rational consideration of how our actions affect other people, questions of what we should or shouldn't do with respect to certain goals, then it's as ridiculous as thinking that you can't, you know, run a marathon if you've never had cancer. So
yeah, I mean, in terms of like when Jordan Peterson's talking about morals, I mean, it's very hard to nail him down on his actual positions, because he rarely just gives straight statements of his beliefs. But, you know, it's often this argument against subjective, the idea of morality being subjective rather than objective. And
yeah,
like, I feel like this comparison moral argument or whatever, I mean, when morality is subjective, which is how I would declare it to be, that's my claim, in that sense, we can only determine something's moral value in comparison to other things. If we created a new universe where we're gods, and we make it so there's only one action possible, then all actions are equally moral. Like, the level of morality is equal.
Morable.
It's all just the same. Morable. You know,
it's a new word.
But then in a world where then we create a second action, then potentially one of those actions is more moral than the other one. But, you know, as we start adding actions, we could add something like, this is completely ridiculous hypothetical scenario, don't think it through too much, but as we get there, like, you know, we're God and we add in like the action of, oh, you could pick the orange or something and you can eat an orange, and like that's morally fine, like whatever. And then, oh, we're going to say I'm picking an apple and that's going to be bad for some reason, like whatever, I don't know. But compared to picking an apple, committing a genocide is like, it's not just a little bit worse, like it's there's a big
apples to genocide, right? That's the phrase, right?
But the thing is though that there could, you know, in when you're a god, you could potentially create actions that have the same difference, worse than genocides, you know. There's so much room for it, and all we can ever do is compare these things, and we can only compare them, like, I mean, to Jordan Peterson's point, you can compare them to what you've done yourself, but also to what is other people have done and what you can theorize, and really that's all there is. So like, to the original question, can you like be a good person without knowing the worst you're capable of? Yes, because you know what some people are capable of, or you can imagine what some people are capable of, and you can not do that. And but then there could be like new good moral actions that we discover. For example, people 100 years ago didn't know that it was morally bad to, you know, just dump chemicals into the sea or whatever, because they didn't understand that. And now we know that it's morally good to try and stop that, to the point where it'd be like, well, I should stop buying products which have this in, and I should stop voting for politicians that won't regulate this thing away. And that's like a new morally good action that potentially didn't exist in the past in the context of our society, etc., etc. But like, you know, it's because it's all subjective and hard to say what it's like. We couldn't rank all the actions, but we can have a discussion about every single possible action and determine whether it's a morally good thing to do or not. And if it is, and it's within your power, then I don't know. That was a little bit of a rambly answer, but I feel like the answer to your question is
don't worry about it.
and Katie's point, right? There is a question of like, what does one have to do with the other? What is making, you know, exploring the space of what good moral outcomes look like? What does that have to do with exploring the space of what bad moral outcomes, you know, would look like, or moral decisions? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the thing about Peterson that drives me nuts is like, to me, this is like, the question of can you be truly good without knowing how truly bad you can be is just this weird, like, silly question, like with a false dichotomy sort of baked into it. Yeah. And when I hear Peterson talking about stuff, you know, it'd be like, he was like, well, could you climb Mount Everest if you haven't made your bed? And I'd be like, well, of course, yes, I could. Sure. And then it'd be like, oh, but can you really, can you, if you haven't gotten your room in order, can you fully, you know, experience the experience? And it's just like, dude, like, what are you talking about? So like, I get that, you know, Peterson in his way is trying to get people to think, and that's a good thing. But
two Peterson dunks before we go. Firstly, every action I've ever done, I've done without making my bed, so fuck you, Jordan.
And
I prefer beds unmade. I think it's nicer when they're all like still cocoon mode from the night before rather than all like straightened up. Anyway, and the other thing is, I will only be super quick, but just because I have the chance, and potentially people in the audience who think he's all right, he's like got famous for dunking on trans people and lying about a law that he was just objectively wrong on. And you can just go look it up. He was factually wrong. He never knew at any point what he was talking about. He's still doing it. He's a knobhead in that sense. He could still... I'm not saying people who like him are bad. I'm not doing a guilty by association. What I am saying is that he has a lot of credibility issues, and it's worth being aware of the full spectrum of the man. It's also worth looking up his diet, because that's another... But he could still be right about climbing Everest and making your bed, but he's also wrong about that. So take every claim on its own, but when he's consistently wrong,
there you go.
Anyway, sorry, Chris, would you like to sum up, and then we'll call it a day?
Yeah, of course.
How do you feel this has affected your view?
I'm sorry, on you go.
No, I was just saying, how has what we've said helped?
It has. I think there is something to be said for, are you really being good if you don't really know? If you have two choices, bad or good, and you go with good, but you know that you're capable of the bad, I think there is something to be said for holding back the darkness within yourself, so to speak. But I think that there is, as you say, I think there is something of a... Well, I'm sorry, I've forgotten the term you used. I think that the two things don't necessarily match up, you know?
It's good to think... some of these questions, it's like, oh, that's an interesting thought, and then it makes you think like, I could, almost every single second that passes by, there's a bad action I could do which would be worse than the one I don't do. Whatever, am I even making these choices
every day?
It's interesting, but don't let it consume you, because lots of what he says is wordy nonsense.
Well, and recognize that good moral decisions exist on a spectrum. So like, in the same way, if you're thinking about what to have for breakfast tomorrow, and you know, maybe the worst thing you could possibly have would be poison, and you decide that you're gonna have, you know, like a
human baby with mayonnaise, mate, much worse.
Yeah, a human baby with mayonnaise would be really, really bad. And then you decide you're going to have a bowl of cereal. Well, is a bowl of cereal the perfect choice? Is that the absolute most optimal, goodest of all good breakfasts that you could have? Probably not, you know.
No.
But did you make a bad choice? You know, where on the spectrum of perfect to worst possible did you land, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the idea is that, like, you know, good moral decisions, it's like it's a journey, not a destination, to get really cliche with it. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. But anyway, thank you very much for this call, Chris. We are gonna have to end because the next show is coming up soon. So thanks for calling in, and it's a really good discussion topic. I'm glad we could get you back on. But right, so quickly, before we do go, we just would like to point out that if you like the show, this extra long show today with loads of cool topics, then you can support us in lots of different ways. You can donate to the fundraiser, which is just below, which the proceeds go directly to the ACA. You could like the video, subscribe to the channel. You can join and become a member and get loads of cool extra features. And that would be really fun and great for us. You can also donate to the Patreon and then get lots of extra cool Patreon stuff. And there you can go to tiny.cc/patreon.th. You can come and check out all of the different AECA shows on the podcast channel at tiny.cc/AENpodcasts. You can come hang out on the Facebook and have an argument that you haven't quite thought through yet and nail it down by getting hammered in the replies. Every time you get ratioed, you learn a little bit more about the world. And that is tiny.cc/FBTHG. Or you can check out the Discord, which I didn't think we mentioned earlier. ACA Discord, etc. It's a cool place sometimes. Also, go and watch the next show, which is the nonprofit.
Some would say the flagship show of the ACA.
So we are sometimes told. Which is 3 p.m. Central today, tiny.cc/YTMP. Sorry for rattling through that, but we wouldn't like to eat into any other show times. So quickly before we go, let's say lots of love and thanks to the crew. Maybe we could get the crew camp up and just do a little hello to all the crew.
There we go.
Yeah. I like the invisible librarian the most. Sorry, everyone else.
What if they were raptured?
Wait, did the rapture happen while we were on air?
Like, we missed it. God damn it.
Yeah, that would be interesting. But yeah, so now let's send out our love rings to all of the viewers and everyone in the community. You know, if you're still deconstructing, deconverting, whatever you want to call it, and sometimes you need a place just to hang out with similar-minded people, people who've been through the same journey, you know, this community is for you. Come and hang out. Sometimes it's hard being an atheist. Sometimes it isn't, and sometimes you just want to rinse theists with rubbish arguments. You know, come out, hang out too. That's a good place. But also, if you're a theist, you know, we obviously would love to talk to you. We don't always rinse you. Sometimes you have good arguments, and we want to hear them. It's good. But yeah, so if you don't believe in anything, this is your community. But if you do believe, we don't hate you.
We're just not convinced.
We want the truth, so watch Truth Wanted live Friday at 7 p.m. Central. Visit tiny.cc/YTTW and call into the show at 512-991-9242 or connect to the show online at tiny.cc/callTW.